We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the people of Missouri. We're for brewmasters, stockbrokers, beauty queens, and truck drivers. Whatever you do, if you're a Missourian, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we've got Missouri covered.
The Interurban Lofts proudly present The Border Patrol with Stephen St. John and Nate Buchanan.
Good morning, my neighbors!
I'm sold. I mean, I think just like any old head, initially it was like, well, I don't know. This is antithetical, right, to the sense of the game. You're going, putting a clock on something that's never had a timer on it. But it just got to the point where there's so much dead time, and it was useless dead time. You know, fixing gloves. You know, pitchers circling the mound. And I think it crystallized it when you watched games in spring training, just to see how crisp it was, and just how quickly the players were like, "Okay, I'm buying into this." I mean, they had a chance to. All of a sudden, you're shaving off 30 minutes of the game. The game's got rhythm. It's got tempo, and things are moving. So, I mean, it's very clear that there's a direct relationship to the adding that clock to just what they were trying to solve.
Good morning, Kansas City. This is the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. It's Friday, March 31st, 2023. Stephen St. John and Nate Buchanan with Marco Marquez. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Last month of March. How about that? Or last day of March. Month's almost over. And then April will begin tomorrow, so March is out of here. And the Royals are out of here because they lost yesterday. What's wrong with the Royals? Is Matt Quatrero on the hot seat? I don't know.
How about those Royals, huh?
The team hadn't even won a game yet. Yeah. Haven't even scored a run yet.
Yeah, that was disappointing. That was, what? Opening day in the books, Twins win 2-0. Royals waste a good pitching performance from Zach Greinke. They are unable to solve the new acquisition by the Minnesota Twins in the offseason. Pablo Lopez, who came over from the Marlins organization, and he looked terrific against the Royals yesterday. Greinke went 5 3rd. 6 hits, 2 runs, 1 walk, 4 strikeouts. Lopez, 5 3rd, 2 hits, no runs, 3 walks, 8 strikeouts. And then the Twins' bullpen finished the job. And the Royals lose. So, but it looked like it was a great day as far as the atmosphere and the weather. And everything else. It looked like people had a blast out there. It was wild, man. It was interesting to check out my Facebook feed. I'm one of the few opening days that I have not attended in my life, and so it was interesting to see. It seemed like everyone in Kansas City was out there. So sold out opening day, but I mean it was. Yeah, you know, I had some regret, but then when I watched the performance, I'm like, I'm where I need to be. But that would have been a blast to be out there with a bunch of friends. I just don't have any.
Oh, that's not true, and you know it.
No. Where's the drop? Vin, that's a perfect for Vin Diesel. I don't have friends.
He's got family.
See, I don't have any friends.
I don't have friends. I got family.
I'm waking up still. Sorry.
See? See? Perfect. See, right there. You got it. You get it now. Who wants to hear my first complaint about the Royals after one game? Huh?
I want to
hear
it.
Who's ready for it? Who's ready for Steven's first complaint one game into the season? Are you really?
Yes. Yeah, let's go.
This is what they call a small sample size, one game. See if you can complete the sentence. I don't like, this has to do with the lineup. I don't like who, where.
You don't like who's batting leadoff.
You don't like...
Why would I not like Bobby Witt Jr.?
I don't know. Maybe you want him batting third.
No, I want him getting as many at-bats as possible.
Okay. You don't like MJ Melendez batting second.
I don't like MJ Melendez batting second. Even when I saw it, like, I don't... Is that... Hey, it's one game. Whatever. What do you want me to do? Just come on the air like, I don't care about nothing. Blah. I do care about stuff. I just look like, I don't.
Yeah.
Is he a two-hitter? Is he with a two-hole?
Well, they were talking about whether or not, when I was out there at practice the other day, they were talking about the debate was, should he hit leadoff and Bobby Witt hit second? Or should Bobby Witt hit second or should Bobby Witt hit first and he hit second?
What's the thought process behind that?
I don't know.
I'm asking you what you think. I know what they think because they put him in the tool.
Well, my opinion is they have a higher opinion of what MJ Melendez is going to be as a hitter than I do.
Right. We're in the same boat there. I don't view MJ Melendez. It's pretty obvious. I don't, and I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like, okay, here, let's be honest. Even though my back is sore after a lengthy physical therapy appointment yesterday, which thank you, Chris, got me going. I actually felt pretty good walking out of there this morning. But even though my back's a little sore, I will still reach around and pat myself on the back. Because I feel like I was on Vinny, you know, pretty early before people were still figuring out who's this, who's he talking about? Who's this moron that just plays rotisserie baseball talking about? And so I think I've liked Vinny more than most people have than they came around. Like, oh, yeah, it's Vinny Pasquantino, right?
Yeah.
Everyone liked Bobby Witt Jr. from the morning, from the moment he was drafted, right? That's no, okay? I feel I've been early on Michael Massey, whatever. But Melendez, I just haven't fallen in love with him as a prospect the way other people have.
Yeah.
Clearly, I see things. I like things. But I just haven't fully wrapped my arms around him. He has power. I mean, I don't know. And maybe it's part of it. It's like, we can't just look at offense when we talk about prospects. Like, what is he? I mean, right off the bat, they had that defensive alignment that we talked about, that you talked about in the outfield, the two outfielders, and, mm-hmm. Kind of like trying to, a way to beat the band, the shift or whatever. And what happened? Well, your glasses fog up, don't they?
A little bit.
Right?
Yeah.
Ground ball right, and you couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Like, okay. That's not a good start, right?
Yeah.
But last year he hit .217 with a .313 on base, sub .400 slug. I don't really care about that. I'm looking for a guy to get on base. I don't know. I'll be proven wrong.
That was the first time in his career that MJ has been placed in the two hole in the lineup.
So, if you want to look at, like, I think what they think of MJ Melendez, you go back to the 2021 minor league season, And between the two stops he had that year, he hit .288 with a .386 on base and a .625 slug. He had 41 home runs. That's an all-world player. I mean, you know, that's OPS of over 1,000. He's getting on base, hitting for power. But that really, like, that was like the one year, you know? I mean, he has not been consistent in his minor league career. And obviously his first stint in the big leagues did not produce. Now, one thing you could say is it seems like it's pretty consistent that his on-base percentage is always about 100 points higher than his batting average. So I guess if you want to dream that he's going to add 50, 60 points to his batting average this year, that on-base percentage becomes more attractive. And I, obviously they're expecting him to develop from what he was last year. And I'm guessing if he plays in the big leagues for a while, he's better than a .217 hitter. But I don't know. He seems to me to be right now like a little bit of a continuation of the old, like we talk a lot about the way the Royals have changed, but this seems to be a little bit of a continuation of the Royals. They have their idea of what a player is going to be, and they really value some of their prospects. You know what I mean? Like, he's one of those guys, they're convinced he's going to be a star. And so we'll see if they're right. But I'm kind of with you. I don't see...
He could be a star without hitting the two-hole.
Yeah. And maybe he doesn't need to start off there, too. I don't know. But they do. Their whole team is young for the most part, right, in the lineup. So I'm with you. I don't really... When I look at him, I don't think, oh, there's a number two hitter right there. But
he had a couple of double plays he grounded into yesterday.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously he had the biggest opportunity of the game and yanked an off-speed pitch down the first base line for, you know, to kill a potential run-scoring situation.
I hope he does well. I hope I'm wrong. I just that when I looked at the lineup and then you know, watching the game yesterday, like, I don't love him in the two-hole, but
yeah, I find it a little interesting myself. But I will say this. I mean, I don't know that I love Bobby Witt Jr. as a leadoff hitter. Isn't the most important thing for a leadoff hitter supposed to be getting on base?
I mean, look, there's different arguments, right?
Yeah, because he can steal bases.
Right. Is he your best player? Is he your best hitter? Is he your best all-around player? Do you want him to get as many plate appearances as possible? Lead him off.
Okay.
Because that's the way some people look at it, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I just feel like I want somebody to get on base. And his on base percentage last year was below .300.
So who does that?
Yeah.
Vinny Pasquantino, but you're not leading him off.
Right. Right.
For reals.
That would be pretty that'd be pretty progressive or something.
Kyle Isabel.
Yeah. I think Kyle Isabel, and see, now there's a guy that I think I like more than they do, and they haven't been, and look, just because they don't love a prospect doesn't mean he doesn't pay. They didn't love Whit Merrifield for a while until he had, like, I know you don't like me to bring up Whit Merrifield because it puts you in a bad mood, but he had to knock down the door.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay? And it seems like, you know, there's been roadblocks for Isabel and Olivares where they haven't really wanted to give them full-time at-bats. And sometimes it's been injury or whatever else. But I like Isabel. And I listen to former players and what they – I do value their opinion, right? And former players love Isabel, just love the way he plays.
Yeah.
And to me, I kind of like him in the two-hole.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. He wouldn't be getting this opportunity if Drew Waters had not been injured, right? And I'm really hoping he capitalizes on the opportunity to get, you know, full-time at-bats the first month until Waters gets back to where they have to look at him like, okay, you know what? He earned a spot in the lineup. We like him. He's got a little bit of speed. I don't know. I like Isabel.
Yeah.
And so he kind of – but then again, is that – me just having backwards old-time baseball thinking like you are, like, You know, he's got to steal some bases. He's got to do this. He's got to fit the profile. Whereas, should we just worry about, hey, put your best players at the top of the lineup and get them the most plate appearances and let the chips fall where they may?
Yeah, that makes sense.
It all makes sense depending on who
Michael
you're
Massey
talking to.
Would be an interesting candidate.
Well, I wasn't going to say that because then
you'd be accused of loving Michael Massey too much. But you know, he always had a decent on base percentage in the minor leagues and can run a little bit. But maybe you're right. I mean,
I almost kind of like Melendez hitting fifth behind Pasquantino.
Yeah,
because even though I think there's some upside to Franmil Reyes, he did not look locked in yesterday. Well, you know, and you're hoping for a bounce back from there, right? From him, and so I don't know. And those, I'm sure this isn't the end all be all, but look, it's opening day. It's one day. What do you want us to do? We're talking about the lineup, all right? We're engaged.
Yeah, I mean, in what was otherwise a not so engaging game. So, the one thing about Melendez hitting right after Pasquantino is you got lefty-lefty. I know they like having lefty-righty-lefty with Melendez, Perez, Pasquantino. You don't care?
I mean, no, I don't. That's fine. Go ahead.
But you know, that way if somebody tries to bring in a situational lefty, they got to keep him for how long you got to keep the guy in now? I don't remember the rules now.
So you pinch hit for these young superstars, they got to hit. You hit righties and lefties.
No, that's what I mean, but it makes it harder for you to bring in a situational lefty if you don't have back-to-back-to-back left-handed batters. So if you stagger them like that, then that makes it harder for the manager on the other team to decide.
Okay, that's overthinking it, I think. I don't know.
Okay. Well,
I don't know.
I think maybe at the end of the day, you're right. If they believe that Witt and Melendez are their top two prospects, and this is a year about finding out, let them hit there all year.
I mean, would you
or
rather
at least for a while?
Would you rather have a good left-handed hitter behind Pasquantino or Franmil Reyes providing air conditioning for the entire front row?
It's cooling everybody off.
Like just because it's a right-handed hitter doesn't mean it's the right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
He
no.
He can't make contact, but he's right-handed, so that'll fix it. I don't know. Yeah. Fine. Sure. Lefty, right, great.
I do know that was part of the thought process there,
sure
in terms
is.
Of
okay,
the way
awesome.
They staggered, because you got Witt right-handed, Melendez left-handed, Perez right-handed, Pasquantino left-handed, and then, you know. I
mean, okay.
You know, is it the rule now that you bring in a guy, he's got to pitch three batters or something like that?
I don't know. See, like, I think that's like, I've always thought that was, you know.
Yeah.
I just have to fall in love with Melendez the way they have.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not there. It's not like I hate him or anything like that, but I just don't. I have my questions as to whether or not he's going to be the kind of star they think he's going to be.
Because that's the prospect that I've said that, and I think maybe you've said it as well, that if they're going to trade somebody to try to gain starting pitching or make a move where it hurts or whatever else, that's the guy that would be on the top of my list.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, what his value is at this point. It's not like he's had a long run of playing poorly, but his time in the big league so far has not been impressive.
He's still got to have some tremendous upside, though, you know.
You'd think so.
But what
How
hurts...
How much has he hurt himself defensively?
As I said, what hurts is there's got to be some teams out there that have watched him catch, like, ah.
He can't catch, and he's not like he's a plus defender.
Well, he's going to have to catch because they only have two catchers. Oh. He's going to have to catch. That's why I was surprised that they didn't keep Felix Fermin, because I thought maybe they had decided, okay, hey, we don't want him to be the backup catcher. We need to get him in the outfield, leave him in the outfield, right? So you're going to see him catch because Salvi ain't catching every game.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about defense, like, if he could catch, then all of a sudden his value goes up so much as an offensive player.
And maybe
you know?
That's why he's going to catch.
Yeah.
Hoping that he can increase his value as a catcher, which would be good for the Royals and good for his trade value and good for everybody.
Because, like, his value as a – like, he's got to hit so much more as a subpar defensive right fielder to become an above-average player than he does at catcher, right? Like, you don't have to hit as well as a catcher to be an above-average catcher.
Royals lose 2-0 on opening day. Back into this on WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I kissed her and she kissed Nate Eaton wouldn't be a bad two-hitter.
I'd like to see me some Nate Eaton in
there. Oh, shut up, Steven. Okay, I will. You know, Jason Anderson and Todd Lebo are down in Houston covering the Final Four and the Radio Row, doing a great job. And I was happy to hear Mizzou head basketball coach Dennis Gates of Hell on the Zone with Jason Anderson. So let me play a clip of this, because I know this is it's the most important storyline of the offseason. Well, did you see Dennis Gates' top assistant, C.Y. Young, was offered the Temple job, and then he said, no. Because I guess that's a blank show right now. And he did not quite have faith in the leadership. And then, like other people, like Jeff Goodman and other national basketball writers were describing the coaching search as a clown show. So, you know. But that shows you, I mean, he's well thought of. And so for him to even get an offer like the Temple job, right? That's
saying something.
You're damn right. And so he stays. So that was the storyline. But, you know, Caleb Love and Jamarion Sharp, the 7'4" guy and 7'5" guy. And there's other players that are going to be really interesting. The saga of Isaiah Mosley that continues into the offseason. But the most important thing this offseason is Kobe Brown and whether or not he comes back. Because if Kobe Brown comes back, then you've got an all-SEC candidate that's coming back. And, I mean, just look at the improvement he made last year under Dennis Gates. Imagine what he could be next year. He'd be one of the best players in the nation. So, and then you'd have to feel like the expectations would be sky high from Mizzou. And so Dennis Gates was asked by Jason Anderson about the possibility of Kobe Brown returning next year.
Well, the most important part in all that is making sure a young man's dreams and aspirations do come true. We want him to figure out what's next, and that's what he and his family are doing now, and that's what we are consistently meeting on. I think building a team to make sure that we can harness the success that we had this year is important. So we're going to continue to recruit the portal, but also we're going to always have young men in this climate. I'll be shocked at how many teams don't have one guy going to portal. I'll be curious what that stat looks like, but I won't only know until August how many guys gone in the portal. But I think it's the normalcy of our game is here, and we have to be fluid. We have to be working toward building a roster, but also retaining a roster. And we have some great players coming back and returning, but we're going to give Kobe Brown and his family the space to figure that out.
When did you realize that, maybe when did he realize he could be that good? Because that's one thing, like the potential, like Missouri fans could see it even as a freshman, like this guy's got some game
absolutely
to him, like an all-around game, but I don't know that I ever saw that where Utah State, it's like he just takes over. Like he goes Kobe, you know, it's like all the kids in the parking lot, Kobe.
We want to continue to encourage him.
Yeah.
Because when I first got here at Mizzou and we had our first workout, he said, Coach, you want me to shoot this? Yes, Kobe, I want you to shoot that ball. What you mean? Or I'm going to take you out the game. So we had a little head button going on when it comes down to how aggressive I wanted him to be as a perimeter shooter. Because I saw the work that he put in. I saw how talented he was, but also his development over the course of the last couple of years that Coach Martin and his staff was able to identify that young man and bring him in, but get him better, right? Yeah. I wanted him to take the next step, right? And that's what he did. He were able to improve his three-point percentage by 25-plus points, percentage points. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
He increased his volume and his efficiency from points to rebounding rate and different things like that. And that's the things that I enjoy watching, the development of a young man.
All right, moving forward, I'm going to play a couple of short clips, Marco, because I wanted to thank you for including these on the list. I appreciate this because Selena and Julia and I are going to watch the women's Final Four tonight. And both games would be, I'm sure, good, yeah. LSU and Virginia Tech. But if you have a daughter that plays basketball or a daughter that plays sports, I would encourage you to watch the Iowa-South Carolina game with her tonight on ESPN at 8 o'clock because Caitlin Clark is the best player, and she is unbelievable. And South Carolina is 36-0. And so it's like that dream matchup, best player, best team. I cannot wait to watch that. Caitlin Clark had a 40-point triple-double in this NCAA tournament, by the way. Here is ESPN women's college basketball analyst Monica McNutt previewing tonight's matchup between Iowa and South Carolina.
Well, I cannot wait for this matchup, and I think, Elle, the stars are going to continue to shine brightly. And let's start with Caitlin Clark, who made history in the Elite Eight with a 40-point triple-double, the first to do that in either men's or women's NCAA tournament play. I think, as lethal as she is as a scorer, in this next matchup, it's going to be her prowess as a playmaker and assisting her teammates that's going to be important. South Carolina has a bevy of athletes that I think may not be able to stop her, but they can make her day at the office particularly challenging. And then when you talk about Aaliyah Boston, I mean, she's practically a walking double-double. She's been so focused this particular season. Her footwork, her passing, her leadership. You hear her talk about how focused this team is on going back-to-back. And it doesn't just start or stop at Boston, for that matter. This is a team that can go 12 deep. Of the four teams remaining, they give you the most points off the bench, y'all, with 30 points off the bench. And so I think the depth of South Carolina could be problematic for Iowa.
You know, there was a time down at Caddyshack, they used to call me a walking double-double, which is a
wow.
Totally different.
Hey.
Not proud of that. I was in
not
my 20s
long.
And nobody cared. Here is South Carolina head coach Dawn Staley talking about facing Caitlin Clark tonight.
We really haven't played against a player like Caitlin and her ability to have a big game and fill up the stat sheet. We have to take something away. If she gets 40 points and 10 assists, you know, that's pretty tough. That's pretty tough for any team to overcome because that means everybody is getting involved. And you can't have everybody getting involved with, you know, how well they shoot the basketball and how well she facilitates.
And finally, here is Caitlin Clark talking about facing South Carolina tonight.
What Coach Staley has been able to build. I mean, she's one of the GOATs. Obviously, the national team head coach. She's, you know, not only an incredible basketball coach, but an incredible person, and I admire everything she's done. And I think the biggest things is, you know, obviously a team that, you know, really can D up. You know, they're going to play really good defense. They're going to rebound the ball. So we're really going to have to execute. You know, we're not going to be able to make too many mistakes, but, you know, we believe going into any game, we just have to be us, and I think that's just going to be the biggest thing is, you know, we understand we're on a bigger stage, but, you know, as long as we play Iowa basketball and be ourselves and have fun, you know, that's all you can ask.
This might make Nate mad, but let me say it. Let's go, Iowa.
I'm with you.
Come on, Iowa.
Yeah.
And, Marco, the big question for you is, with South Carolina as an 11.5-point favorite, do we tonight gamble on women's basketball?
Yeah, I was talking about this yesterday at the Royals game with Jesse Newell.
Jesse and Marco at the Royals game talking about gambling on women's basketball. That's the kind of conversation I like to hear about. So you decided yes.
Yes on Iowa.
Iowa and the 11.5?
Yeah, I'd take Iowa and 11.5. Right. Got the best player in the country.
Let's go DraftKings Sportsbook. Back after this on WHB.
Dancing to the music played by the DJ on the radio. The Cokes are
welcome back to
spot.
The Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stephen St. John and Nate Buchanan with Marco Marquez on this Friday, March 31st, 2023. Now joined by Stan Weber in studio. Stan, how you doing this morning, man?
Well, I'm doing well. It feels like spring. It smells like spring. It sounds like spring. That's good news around here, and it's baseball season. But I have to say, sitting here with you guys reminds me that I was not with you last Friday.
Right.
We had a good discussion, and it was that close as I make my fingers close together. to me being in Houston right now. So I guess I'm not doing as well as I thought I was when I was walking in, because now that you asked the question, I go, you know, I could be in Houston at a Final Four, so the difference is pretty big. But otherwise, yeah, it's good to be here, and who can ever expect starting a year that you deserve to go to the Final Four? With K-State being so close, it's you could see, you know, remember those plays, those 6, 7, 8, 10 plays. There were a lot of them that could have made a difference in the ball game, and yet FAU is really good. So that's why. Hopefully that was my message. I haven't gone back and listened to what I said last week to you guys, but hopefully the take was FAU is really good.
Yeah, I mean, how much time was left when K-State took a 7-point lead?
And was it 6 minutes left?
Yeah,
or?
and then when I'm trying to think how much we were all at main event watching the game.
8:36.
Okay, and I looked at my
right here, Nate.
And I looked at my buddy Caesar. Were you close? Did you nail it?
No, he did. He's got it all written down.
I tracked the game right there.
So I looked at my buddy Caesar.
You got that, Nate?
And I said, okay, State's winning this game. Because it felt like that, right? I can't speak for you. You're there calling the game courts. It just felt like, okay, here it is. Now they're gonna put the finishing touches on. This is it. And we always focus on what the losing team didn't do, but you're right. I mean, like FAU, I mean, they've won, what is it, 35 games now? I mean, yeah. they were up against the ropes, right? But they came back, and I mean, it came right down to the wire. But I mean, either team could have won that game. I mean, I thought K-State had it at that point.
It does the kind of things you flip through your head. Wow,
right?
Because if you just were fair, you'd say, well, Keontae Johnson got in foul trouble. Right or wrong, that was the biggest story of the game when it's all said and done. Yeah. But if you accept that, then FAU was the better team. They played really well all game long, and they go 9 deep. They score more points off the bench than any team in the country. So they bring it, and they played well, and they made their shots. And you could say, you know, they deserve to win the game. But in the face of that still being true, K-State had a 7-point lead. You know, whoa, wait a second. How did this turn around? And now all K-State has to do is just finish it down the stretch, put a little stress on FAU, and you're out of here. But, you know, the biggest thing going into the game that I monitored was you get a team that wins like this, and they do not give up. They do not think about losing, and they are so hard to beat. And that's a big philosophy of mine. I guess if you're going back in pre-tournament and you're looking at the 68 teams, any team that's got around 30 wins or long winning streaks, give them a little bit of extra juice in your bracket. But these guys have won 11 straight, 14 of 15. They had a 20-game win streak at one point in the season, and they're 35-3 right now.
And isn't it always, doesn't it always go this way? Like, you think back to, you know, some of the runs KU's made to the Final Four of the championship. They have that one game where, you know, they could have lost or they should have lost that game, but they got through it. I watched the majority of that FAU-Memphis game. Yeah. Memphis should have won that game.
Even down to the last
Memphis
20 seconds.
Memphis got screwed out of that game. and so it's like, and I mean, because, you know, I'm watching that game, and I'm, you know, Frank Hayes on the bench with Penny Hardaway, and then that happens where they don't, you know, Memphis had the ball, and they call a timeout, but they call the, you know, the jump ball, which helped decide the game, and after the game, Penny Hardaway fires his water bottle in no specific direction, and that
a
was
long a, ways by the way.
Right,
it was notable,
but that was the whole thing. Like, oh man, Memphis should have won that game. FAU got is lucky to get out of there, and now they're in the Final Four.
It's yeah, just, and the conference wild. The thing that we didn't notice as well is Conference USA, how good it is.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has any interest in taking in an NIT game.
North Texas and UAB.
They're both in the same conference. They played each other 4 times this year. Mm. One of the 3 losses by FAU is to UAB. But you look at how many times they beat North Texas and what they had to do to win the tournament to get in as well. They didn't really – they thought they might get an at-large bid, but Dusty May said after he talked further after the tournament was over, some people were telling him, I don't know, if you'd have lost in the first round, you might have been out. So they didn't realize how much of their back was to the wall, but they went ahead and beat them again. The UABs of the world, the North Texases of the world, well-coached, play well. those teams are sitting. North Texas is sitting on 31 wins right now.
And Grant McCaslin
and UAB's 29.
Yeah, he's headed to Texas Tech now. C.J. Moore's been on him for the past couple of years. Every time a job would open, boy, they better look at Grant McCaslin, and he got, what, a six-year, $18 million deal? I mean, the minute that they won the NIT, the report came out, Grant McCaslin headed to Texas Tech. And so that just, you know, proves your point.
So FAU won the conference and then won the tournament against that kind of competition. Yeah. They did catch a break with Memphis, and then they played FDU, so they're kind of quietly moving in. But, you know, Dusty May is worth noting because he could be a name that pops. He's been there for 5 years, and they had a winning record. And I don't know how to evaluate FAU to say that was really good. What they're telling me now, being around the program a little bit more, that was really good that he got him to a winning record. But it didn't pop like Jerome Tang. Whoa, look where K-State went. So you didn't see that with Dusty May. But when you start studying him, and I got a chance to meet his family. His son is a player at Florida, a walk-on at Florida. Great friends with Keontae Johnson, K-State's player. He was at Florida and recruited Keontae. There were those ties. But he was a manager for Bob Knight at Indiana. So getting a chance to talk to him one-on-one, he was kind of chuckling and saying, you know, deep down, I've got a lot of that fire and the old school mentality of what needs to be done. But I've learned over time that this isn't the way that works with the modern kids. And he gave me the example of, he said, I really didn't realize that till I saw my oldest son, who is a fiery guy, a little too emotional, responding to referees or missed shots or whatever. He said, I saw him come off, get pulled out of the game, and the coach just put his hand gently on his shoulder and talked to him, and he said, I could just see the stress leaving his body right there. He's my son. I was watching the game, and I could see the stress leaving his body, and I go, there's different ways of doing this. So the point is that he's bought in to the modern way of coaching players, but deep down, he's got that old fire and discipline. So you mix the two together, and you get a pretty good product. And then Elijah Martin, I hate to say these things, but when I watched him first, I said, well, he'd be a perfect transfer portal guy to come to K-State. I mean, the guy's 6'2", 210, unbelievable. He hit it. To give FAU credit, when the game was just up for grabs, they fought through the seven-point deficit, he hit a big three. And it wasn't a inside-out pass where you knock him down. He was coming off a pick, coming from the block, past his guy, turning at the top of the key, plus catching a turn and rips a three to put them up in a big situation. So they've got some guys. And hopefully the other thing I said to you guys was they get talked about as a three-point shooting team averaging almost 10 a game, 18 games where they have 10 or more 3 points a game. Their big guys are really, really good.
They dominated the boards.
Yeah, and 40, they out-rebounded 42. Tennessee. Did you realize that? No one talked about that when the game was over. Look at those big guys from Tennessee. FAU out-rebounded them. And Vlad Golden, 7'1" transfer from Texas Tech, had 14 points, 13 rebounds against K-State, and some easy dunks. He was a big difference maker in a game. And then off the bench, Giancarlo Rosato, they run a whole different offense. When he comes in, they go to a Princeton-style offense, getting the ball at the top of the key. So the big guys at FAU are so underrated, and I tried to make that point. They win all those things, but still, I could call out 10 plays that if you turn it differently, K-State would have won the game. That's how close they were.
We've got Stan Weber in the studio back after this on WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stan, the final possession where K-State did get a shot off, I'm just curious, from your perspective, what happened? What went wrong there? I'm sure that you've replayed that several times in your mind.
I tried not to. The thing that FAU had done throughout the second half was they are pressuring their defense further up toward half court more than I've seen almost any team. So they were creating a lot of. Didn't allow a lot of space in that area. They'd have four guys above the top of the three-point line and stuff, and it seemed like that play kind of ran into that. That they're already playing that defense. They did a good job. Normally, you see an opportunity to run into a three-pointer, and I think you'd want Marquise Noel to, you know, stop and shoot, what, 3 feet from where the first defender is that could be a pressure, because he needs a little room to launch that thing, but he has unlimited range. He really can knock down a shot all the way to half court without making it a half-court heave. And You know, they'd had so many times where Ish Masood hit big shots from the right side of the court. So it sounds like Marquise Noel said, I need to create something to get it over to Ish and have him have the shot. Where most people would have said, hey, Marquise, you got 30 points. You've been put on a show in Madison Square Garden. You've made up in a lot of ways for the missing time that Keontae Johnson had out there. Let's make sure we go down with you shooting the basketball. And then when it drips away and flies away, you know what it reminded me of? Michigan State. When they were getting ready for their three-pointer, the same thing happened. The ball kind of got lost on the ground way outside the three-point line, and all of a sudden it started rolling away, and you go, this is over. Marquise Noel went and grabbed it in overtime, and he took it and made a layup for K-State to win by five. But it just, that was the flashback I had. More than breaking down the play too much, I go, this is just like Michigan State. They're trying to gear up for something. Didn't happen. The ball gets tapped away, rolling on the ground, and you could just wait for the buzzer. You know, it seemed like it lasted 20 seconds as you just go, there's no chance K-State's going to grab that ball and shoot. It's all over. And it didn't seem like K-State had a good possession there, that something was almost there and it just dropped the ball. It looked like it was convoluted and well-defensed the whole time.
So this Final Four, there's we talk about a lack of buzz around the Royals. There's been a lack of buzz to me around this Final Four, and I'm looking at this article that explains why. The lowest ticket price to attend both women's games tonight is $428, while the lowest price to go to the men's games on Saturday is $40. Now, there's a huge disparity in the number of tickets, right? 20,000 seat arena for the women, but 70,000+ for the men. But the women do have, you know, Caitlin Clark, the reigning player of the year against, last year's player of the year, and an undefeated 36-0
team
against the best player in the nation. And so that's going to be, me and my daughters are having a watch party for that tonight to watch it. That is freaking awesome, right?
It's notable. Like, the first game, Kim Mulkey Robinson brings a little intrigue because she won so much at Baylor and then got sideways with them. Well, she was sideways with them probably for 10 years. But
seems like she's sideways with a lot of people.
I've heard that. Anyway, she goes to LSU and immediately has him in the Final Four.
Right.
That is incredible.
That's exactly
right.
That is
incredible.
She's a character. You know, whether you like her or you're not.
Very flamboyant.
She says stuff that you remember. She wears things you remember. Like, she just...
Right, so
they're a little bit of a story to me.
LSU to Virginia Tech, but then you got...
But the next game really does... To hit the sports calendar for me and say, that's something I'm looking for tonight when you have baseball and even the XFL or whatever... That's a big thing tonight to see.
Everything
can Caitlin
want.
Actually overcome
right.
the excellence and dominance of South Carolina? Because it may be, South Carolina by 15, and we may be laughing like one person is not going to beat this team.
But
if she does,
the current Naismith Award winner versus last year's Naismith Award winners, it's all these storylines. Think about, and I'm not doing this to upset you, Stan, because I'm watching the game with Caesar. We're watching. He goes, dude, if K-State wins, Houston is going to be purple for the Final Four. But think about this, okay? When Kansas City, we were disappointed in the teams we got here because there was a good crowd and everything else, but it could have been so much more had we had some kind of local connection with one of these teams. Think about what it almost was for just if you look at the Elite Eight games. They could have had K-State, freaking K-State would have been in Houston. Creighton, it would have been equal to, but I mean, Creighton, I believe the entire city of Omaha would have been in Houston. Texas, if they would have won, they would have turned out huge.
Well, they live in Houston.
Right. And so then that's it. Now it's like FAU and Miami, and up there is UConn, over there is San Diego
State. Or Houston
would
have made it themselves.
Right.
Whoa.
And so now it's like all the possibilities they could have had, they're right on the cusp of. But even those two games coming right down to the wire, even if they didn't get a Texas team and they just had K-State and Creighton, how wild would that atmosphere have been?
It's incredible.
They could have sold 100,000 tickets.
I don't know how you guys saw it on television, but it was amazing how many K-State fans were in New York City. And how many of my friends, even that I knew, who came in for the second game who weren't there for the first game.
Yeah.
It's like spur of the moment. I don't care what the tickets cost. Let's go. Can you imagine if they would have had a chance to go to Houston? And there are a lot of graduates in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, K-State, that's one of the places, a lot of schools in our area here. You know, you're going to go to Dallas. You may get into Houston. So many locals would have been right there. Their friends would have got called, hey, come hang out with us. But K-State fans would have valued getting to the Final Four for the first time since 1964. It would have been crazy because New York was crazy. It was amazing how many K-State fans were there. So, yeah, Stephen, oh, boy.
But, like, if you're the Houston, like,
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
like,
Houston's looking at Dallas again because guess where the Women's Final Four is?
Yeah, right.
Dallas.
I mean, it's just, you know, it does go to show you why star power matters, too. Because, like, how many people, even, like, people that are moderate basketball fans can name somebody on the Florida Atlantic roster, you know, or San Diego State's roster? It doesn't mean they're not good players, but they're not the players that you've heard of all year long. Or, that, you know, that you and the storyline that you talked about of this one-star player for Iowa against this juggernaut of a team, those kind of storylines, they make such a big difference. I'm actually think it's going to be an exciting Final Four to watch, but it's like, the diehard, those of us that really like college basketball are going to watch, and a lot of people are just going
to,
you know.
But none of those fan bases have an easy trip to Houston.
No, that's true. And they're not, like, I don't know. If you're from San Diego.
How many K-State and Creighton fans would be down there if that was the match?
Oh, it would have been.
Just thinking how many Nebraska football fans would have adopted Creighton. Right. Seriously.
Yeah.
Because Nebraska's never won an NCAA tournament game.
Well.
So.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
It's true.
We'll take a quick break back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.